In our last session, we were looking at another one of Joseph's tests of his brothers that had come to him. And this last test, his last test was to hold back Benjamin because Joseph's servant had planted that silver cup in the sack of grain that Benjamin was taking back with his brothers to Canaan on their second trip. And the servant came, and they saw the cup, and they charged them with thievery. And these guys were bewildered. They were tearing their clothes. They were so beside themselves. And what we saw last week that I'm just going to quickly review was this magnificent plea that Judah had in front of Joseph. They didn't know it was Joseph. This magnificent plea that he did not want Benjamin to stay there. Oh, anything but that. Because Joseph said, no, I'm going to keep Benjamin. I'm going to keep him here. You go back, I'm going to keep Benjamin. And they didn't want that because they knew what their dad was going to say. Judah realizes this situation and going, oh no, I got to start pleading here. You know, if you remember, he made this pledge to Jacob, let me go. We'll take Benjamin. That's what they want. They want Benjamin. And if something happens, I'll be in Benjamin's stead. I'll be a pledge for him. Bring all the grief on me. So now he's actually making good on this promise, but he's doing it with Joseph. He's not doing it with his dad. So he approaches Joseph. Now you have to get the picture here of the largest, most powerful nation in the world, the second most powerful ruler, and he's a sovereign ruler. He can declare who lives and who dies. He does anything he wants. There's no governing rule, so to speak. They had a few moral rules, but it was all politics and anything went that they wanted. And one of the typical rules is, in all sovereigns, is an individual does not approach a sovereign unless you're requested. If they push their stick to you and say, the scepter that is, and they say you can approach, then you can. Otherwise, you're subject to a capital punishment, and the guards in the court could very easily just kill you because they don't know what your intent is by approaching the sovereign unrequested. So he does this. He just goes up to Joseph and he starts talking to him. I mean, his motivation to keep his father from having a heart attack here was really, really strong. He didn't want to disappoint his dad. He knew how disappointed his dad was years earlier, 22 years earlier, when they went and told their dad, Joseph died. Yep, here's his blood on his coat. You know, what they had done is they killed an animal and they spilled the blood on it. So they were play acting. And they saw how grief-stricken Jacob was, and all Judah's doing is, man, I'm going to avoid this at all costs. I'm not going through this again. So he starts relating his previous conversations with Joseph. And he's reiterating the same issue. You know, look, my brother's dead, and his mom is dead. My dad doesn't have anybody that was truly close to him. And Joseph's looking at this and thinking, man, this guy is looking pretty changed. You know, I don't see the envy here anymore. I don't see the unwholesomeness. And Judah's doing everything he can to avoid prison. Also, he doesn't want Benjamin in prison. And he doesn't know if Benjamin actually took this cup or not, but he just doesn't want this to happen. He just does not want this to happen. So he continues this plea. And he's talking to him and going through everything that has happened. He's still not realizing that this is Joseph. And he's saying that Jacob says, I have not seen him since. And if he take this one from me and harm befall him, he will bring down my gray hairs to Sheol. Now, Judah doesn't realize that Joseph's testing him, but he's living out the experiences that he has had, and he sees how wrong he's been. And he tells Joseph that if he doesn't bring Benjamin back, Jacob's going to die because his life is bound up in this kid. It's just bound up in this kid. And he says, look, I don't want to be the one to blame for this. He didn't do anything. And finally, he just begs. He begs Joseph to exchange Benjamin for him. Judah says, look, let me take his place. And so, you know, Judah just doesn't want the evil that's going to come to Jacob to happen. He doesn't want to be part of that. And Joseph starts to soften, finally. He'd been testing these brothers, and he now becomes convinced that there's been a transformation. So we've seen Joseph being unable to contain his emotions on several instances in the past, going through this portion of Genesis. But he always went away. He either turned his head, went to another room, but now he just can't contain himself. So he screams out in this real loud cry, get everybody out of here. The text says, cause every man to go out from me. And there stood no man with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. Now, it wouldn't be appropriate for the second highest guy in the most powerful nation in the world to have other government people around that reported to him while he's having this emotional outpouring in this reunion. And he had been testing them. He wasn't going to test them as strong anymore, but he would continue to test them right up to the end of this book. He's going to be continually testing them. And again, you know, you forgive people for the sins against you, but you don't have to put yourself back in that situation. You have to be wary when somebody does something that harms you. Are they going to do it again? You got to forgive them. You don't have to put yourself right back there and be vulnerable. God never tells us to do that. But this weeping and this crying and this reunion is so loud that all the servants heard it, even though they were outside of the palace here, and so did the people in Pharaoh's house, in the royal court. And finally, Joseph says, look, just I gotta really know, is my dad still alive? I mean, is he really alive? You know, and you could just sense this Joseph. He knows that they're changed, but he just wonders how much has been puffed up here. I mean, how much have they just been telling him that really may not be true? He didn't have an interpreter in the room because he'd sent everybody out. So now he's talking to them in their native Hebrew language. And he hadn't used this on a daily basis for 22 years. His brother's reaction is one of absolute terror. I mean, they are just terrorized at what's taken place here. They tried to kill him. They put him in a cistern. They sold him away. They were extremely envious. They lied to their dad about what happened. And they've been lying all along. They come to Egypt to get grain. They find out that this guy, who is the second in command, the royal viceroy, the governor, is Joseph. Can that be true? Now just think back to the dinner that they had that we looked at a couple weeks ago. Look back at the dinner where Joseph placed the brothers in sequence by age. There's 11 of these guys, and he placed them in sequence by age, and you can only imagine what they're looking around. How did this happen? Now, the probability of that happening is almost 40 million to one. I showed you the math a few weeks ago. 40 million to one. So they are getting this buildup of anxiety over this whole thing. It's just, this is just too strange. Now, the Hebrew text just shows that they're sheerly terrorized. They knew exactly what they'd done with them, and they remember those dreams that he had where they were bowing down to him and how envious they were. Joseph's innocent dreams that he just wanted to share with his brothers caused their envy to be fueled, where they wanted to kill him. Judah and Reuben intervened, of course, and they didn't kill him, but they sold him into slavery. You know, what's better? I mean, what is really better here? Going into slavery in a ancient prison. I've seen the prisons in the Middle East, and they are not nice places. Not nice places at all. Then his whole countenance is softened to the point where he says, "Come near to me, I pray you." And they approach him. He says, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom he sold into Egypt." In other words, "I'm the guy. I'm the guy you did this to 22 years ago." And he says, "And now be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that ye sold me hither. For God did send me before you to preserve life." God did send me before you to preserve life. In other words, this is part of God's divine sovereignty and master plan. And we see this in the nation Israel throughout the scriptures from the very beginning right to the end. So Joseph is announcing here as a prophet that Elohim had brought him in to Israel or into Egypt to preserve the nation Israel. It's a mystery to us how God works. We see things like this in the scripture. We know God's promises. He always gets his way. We just don't understand it with the chaos that we see when we look out there and the sin, the wars, the political posturing, the angst, all the nasty things that happen between people. We just don't get it. God always gets his way. Always gets his way. All of the actions and attitudes in this world are like a giant mosaic or a giant puzzle that God has complete control over. He lets us sin. He lets us act the way we act. But he gets his will done through this. And it's a mystery. It's a mystery. Now, they are going to go into Egypt in order to preserve them and refine them. There's 70 of them. We'll see next week who they are that go in from Canaan and into Egypt, including Joseph and his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, which we haven't met yet. They will stay in Egypt for 400 years. And when they come out in the Exodus, they're over 2 million strong, and they are a rock-solid nation that God has refined in that cauldron of persecution in Egypt under different pharaohs, not under the Hyksos pharaoh that welcomed Joseph and his family. So Joseph instructs them, and he says, "Look, go back to Canaan, let Jacob know what happened, where I am, and you guys are going to have to relocate here." And he wants to relocate them to Goshen, which is up on the north and east side of the Nile Delta. It's a very fertile area. At that time, was relatively unpopulated, so there wouldn't be many Egyptian citizens that they would have to relocate there. Still close enough to Memphis to be close to the palace. Joseph was an excellent planner, and he'd proven himself that he could do this. So he put them in just the right spot, and he says, "Bring all your livestock, because they're going to perish in the famine too," he says, "unless you do this." And as a final emotional measure there, he's weeping and kissing Benjamin, and then he kisses the rest of his brothers. Now, this was followed by a big reunion that they had, because it had been 22 years since they were together. Joseph was now 39 years old. 39 years old. He'd been governor of Egypt for 9 years. He became prime minister, viceroy, whatever you want to call him, when he was 30 years old. Now, for today's material, we're going to look at how Pharaoh reacted to this. To this reunion. And the text in Genesis 45, verses 16 to 20 reads, "And the report thereof was heard in Pharaoh's house, saying, Joseph's brethren are come, and it pleased Pharaoh well and his servants. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, Say unto thy brethren, This do ye, lade your beast, and go and get you into the land of Canaan. And take your father and your households, and come unto me, and I will give you the good of the land of Egypt, and ye shall eat the fat of the land. Now thou art commanded, This do ye, take you wagons out of the land of Egypt for your little ones and for your wives, and bring your father and come. Also, regard not your stuff, for the good of the land of Egypt is yours. Excuse me. So the news reaches Pharaoh's household. We just saw that. But Pharaoh now knows because they tell him. And he's got a plan. He says, hey, why don't you go get the rest of your family? You know, there's a couple of good reasons for this. One, you got this huge famine going on, and we haven't experienced famine, so we can't quite get that good, strong picture of experience. But this is a devastating time, and Joseph, who had saved the country through storing in the granaries and the obvious silos here around the cities, was dispensing this at a profit during the famine. And Pharaoh needed Joseph. I mean, he liked Joseph, but he needed Joseph. And there's more motivation than just, you're a nice guy, Joseph. You're helping things out here. I really need you. And if you think through this, the Pharaoh was a Semite Hyksos. Joseph was a Semite Jew. Now, the Hyksos came into Egypt, and they took over, starting in around the Nile, and then into Memphis, and then they went into Upper Egypt, which is farther down south the Nile. But Joseph never did assimilate into the culture. He continued to worship Jehovah Elohim. He continued to avoid the pagan polytheistic religions that they had there. And we have to remember that the Egyptians were really xenophobic. I mean, they just viewed themselves as a better class of people, and they weren't going to mix with these folks. They weren't going to eat with them. Pharaoh tried as hard as he could to integrate Joseph into the culture. Remember the parade? He had to marry one of their priest daughters, Asenath. He had him plugged into high society here. He still wasn't an Egyptian. And Pharaoh was ruling with power, not with a, one could call, legitimate ascendancy to the throne. So he needed Joseph. He needed him. He needed to have him there. They're in this famine. And this is another way for him to have Joseph stay, by bringing his family. You know, once Joseph had this reunion, and he had taken care of the provisions for the famine, he could have easily thought, well, it's time for me to go then. Time for me to go back to Canaan. I got everything settled here. I'm in almost complete control of the country, so I can do whatever I want. But Pharaoh wants him to come there, and Joseph is realizing that this is God's will. So Pharaoh makes some commands here. He says, take wagons, and this is the first mention of wagons in the Bible, and the Egyptians were the first people that we know of in Scripture to have these small two-wheeled carriages, and they were just everywhere because they could be used in places where there weren't any roads. So the instructions are given to the brothers to return to Canaan and bring the entire family without burdening themselves with too many utensils and furniture and that, because Pharaoh says, look, I'm going to provide all this stuff for you. I'm going to give you the best of the land here. And Pharaoh wanted Joseph and his family to stay there. He wanted him to stay there. And when they came, and when he realized who they really were, it must have impressed them that these weren't a group of slaves. Now, if you remember back to Joseph being in prison and giving an interpretation to the cupbearer about his dream that he would be restored in 3 days, when Pharaoh had his rebirthing day, as they called it, didn't call it a birthday, he would be restored. And he said to the cupbearer, when you're restored, please tell Pharaoh that I don't belong here. I'm not born a slave. I came from a good family. As a matter of fact, probably the wealthiest family in Canaan, because of the Abrahamic covenant, because of the blessings, the material and the spiritual blessings that came. And, of course, the cupbearer, wasn't politically expedient for him to go up against Potiphar in the royal court, so he didn't say anything. But now Pharaoh's finding that hey, these are royal people too, just from a different country. These are not slaves. They weren't born as slaves. So they depart, and the text in Genesis 45, verses 21 to 25 reads, "And the sons of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them wagons according to the commandment of Pharaoh, and gave them provisions for the way. To all of them he gave each man changes of raiment. But to Benjamin he gave 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of raiment. And to his father he sent this manner, 10 asses laden with the good things of Egypt, and 10 she-asses laden with grain and bread, and provisions for his father by the way. So he sent his brethren away, and they departed, and he said unto them, See that ye fall not out by the way. And they went up out of Egypt and came into the land of Canaan unto Jacob their father." So Joseph is carrying out Pharaoh's commands to do this, to go get them. And he gives all of his brothers new clothes. Except in addition to new clothes, he gives Benjamin 300 shekels of silver. I made a mistake in your notes, sir. I put 100 shekels of silver. He got 300 shekels of silver. It's another test. It's another test to see, just to make sure that these guys are still not masquerading about this, because they're in a difficult situation and they're trying to talk their way out of it. No, he's going to test them again. He's going to be testing them again. He just didn't have complete trust in him. And again, it's important for us to remember, we must forgive those that harm us. That doesn't mean that we got to trust them, that they won't do whatever it is that they have done to us again. You got to be wary. Just like when Christ sent that first group of disciples out evangelizing, he said, "You be as wary as serpents, but as gentle as doves." In other words, you yourself have the right attitude, but just know what this world is like. And you beware of what this world is like and what they'll do. So, he's also telling his brothers when he sends them out, he says, no quarreling. No quarreling between you. I don't want you doing this again. Because he knew exactly what they would do. They had done it in the past. Maybe they changed. Maybe they weren't going to do that anymore. But just in case, he tested them again and he admonished them. You know, Joseph now had the power to correct them by throwing them into prison if he wanted to. So they had to listen to him. He now was in a position of authority with the ability to execute that authority. And I don't mean just necessarily kill them, but I mean to enact his authority, to force them to do what they needed to do in righteousness. Anyway, finally the text tells us that they departed to the north and to the east into Sinai, where they moved up into southern Canaan to Beersheba, where their dad was. And Beersheba is in the southernmost boundary of Israel, right on the Negev, which is the wilderness of the desert. The text moves on to them meeting with Jacob when they go back. Genesis 45, verses 26 to 28. And they told him, saying, Joseph is yet alive, and he is ruler over all the land of Egypt. And his heart fainted, for he believed them not. And they told him all the words of Joseph, which he had said unto them. And when he saw the wagons which Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob their father revived. And Israel said, It is enough. Joseph, my son, is yet alive. I will go and see him before I die. So the brothers immediately go to Jacob to tell him that Joseph is alive and he's the viceroy of Egypt. He's the top guy underneath Pharaoh. Now, Jacob knew these guys. He knew what they were like. It wasn't a mystery to him. And he didn't believe them at first. Matter of fact, his heart was shaken. It's interesting that the Hebrew text here is really interesting, because the word that is translated as, and they told him, is Vayagadu, Vayagadu. And the way that it's spelled in only this instance, it's missing a letter. It's missing a letter. So there's some reason that the letter's missing. And there are non-canonical books that the Jews have written, like the Book of Yasher, where they attempt to describe this, this shock that Jacob was going through. Now you think about this, 22 years, his favorite son's gone, he thinks he's dead, and now he's hearing that he's alive, and he's got the top job in the greatest, most powerful nation in the world. I mean, you're going to listen to this stuff and you're going to think, come on, you guys, you know. He's getting ready for heart failure here. And look at what these guys say. The text of this Book of Yashar says that in order to soften the blow, because the dad was old, plenty old, they didn't want him to have heart failure. So the text here says, with him being very old and susceptible to a potentially deadly shock at the news of this sort, they enlisted the aid of a daughter of Asher, one of the sons who played the lute. They had her sing and play this melody. Joseph, my uncle, is living, and he ruleth throughout the land of Egypt and is not dead. So Jacob's listening to this. It's not a confrontation. It's just somebody, you know, one of his granddaughters singing off in the side here. And his granddaughter, so while Jacob is speaking to his granddaughter, his sons arrive dressed in the luxurious garments that Joseph had given them and repeated the refrain that he was alive and ruled Egypt as Pharaoh's viceroy. Now, whether or not this is credible, it makes some sense that they had to soften this somehow. They just couldn't come and blurt this out because they knew how old Jacob was. And they didn't want him to die before he went back down or he went into Egypt. So he hears this melodious song. It doesn't put him into cardiac arrest, but the text does say that his heart fainted. And the Hebrew is pretty strong there. His heart fainted. It's not hyperbole, although some think it is. You know, it's hard to imagine after 22 years you're seeing your favorite son of your favorite wife alive. And he's just... come on, can this be? I don't know what to say. He sees the empty wagons that are ready to move back. He sees the asses that have the food for them to last on the way back, the gifts that Pharaoh's given them. So he says, it is enough. Joseph, my son, is yet alive, and I will go to see him before I die. And the text here starts to integrate his new name, Israel, into the text, and they start to use it interchangeably. So we start to move from Israel to Joseph or Jacob and back to Israel again. The new name is really pertaining to the nation that's going to come from his loins. The nation that he creates is not Jacob, it's Israel. Israel is the name of the nation. You know, he's realizing that he is part of this, somehow, this Abrahamic covenant. Somehow he's part of this. He's been a big part of his life. All the patriarchs knew that this covenant was, knew how they'd been blessed spiritually and physically, and they knew that something big was going to happen to them. So he's determined that he's going down to Egypt, this time with divine appointment. So in order to go, he is dependent upon God, as he has been in the past, and he meets with God to sacrifice and pray. Now the text, starting in Genesis 46, verses 1 to 4, reads, "And Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices unto the God of his father Isaac. And God spake unto Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here am I. And he said, I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down to Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again. And Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes." So Jacob leaves. All his livestock, he's got most of his belongings, and he's near Beersheba, but he stops at the place where Isaac has prayed the sacrifice and Abraham has prayed the sacrifice, and he makes an offering. Now, Abraham and Isaac both called upon the name of the Lord in Beersheba. It's a very, very special place. And we've seen this in Genesis 21:33 and 26:25. He's offering sacrifices, and the text states, to the God of his father Isaac. Now, it's important to understand that this is also referring by inference to his grandfather, Abraham, because the Hebrew word for father and grandfather are the same. It's Av, A-V, that we would write it. It just means your father, your grandfather, your great-grandfather. So he's referring to the patriarchs here. And Jacob had at least three concerns. One, are these kids telling me the truth? There's a famine going on. You know, are we going to have enough to live? And he's thinking about the promises of this Abrahamic covenant that God is saying to him, I'm the God of your father Isaac, and by inference, Abraham. And so he must be thinking about how he's going to be involved in the implementation of this covenant. But he's under great stress, incredible stress, and he has to meet with God. He's got to pray. He's got to ask God for his will. This is the eighth and last time that we know of, at least in Scripture, that's given to us explicitly, that he is meeting with God in a vision. But he's using his new name here in this particular instance, interchangeably again with that of Jacob. This is final validation or certification that the name Israel will be his name and used for the progeny that's going to come from him. And that nation is going to be refined over the next 400 years. And again, what we're going to see next week is the names of those 70 people in his family that were going to come. And then the over 2 million when they come out in the Exodus, 1445 B.C., God calls out to him in rapid succession two times, Jacob, Jacob. And whenever you see this in the scripture, it has some degree of importance when there's something repeated. And here, it's almost as if God's saying, look, listen up, look up, pay attention here. He identifies himself as the one that made the covenant. I'm the covenant maker. Now, this is the first time that God has told any of the patriarchs to go to Egypt. Both of them, Isaac and Abraham, went down there. They shouldn't have gone. It was not God's doing. They went down there and they both had issues. They both had problems. Jacob left the land once and went to Haran at his mother's behest so that his brother wasn't going to kill him. Remember his brother now, Jacob's brother Esau was going to kill him. He had to get out of there. That's where he got his wives. But this is the first time he's been told to leave the land. But he's also told, I'm going to bring you back. I'm going to bring you back. That's a divine decree that I'm going to bring you back. As a great nation, he's going to bring them back. Now remember, the xenophobia of the racism, if you will, the only valid part of it that I see here, valid use of that term, is of the Egyptians against anybody else are going to cause the Israelis to intermarry and become a big family, a big nation. They're not going to intermarry within the Egyptians. They just don't do that. Exodus 1:7 shows us that too. And God is promising to be with him. He's comforting him by saying, look, I'm going to be with you. I am going to be with you. I will go down with thee unto Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up. And it's a twofold promise here. One, he's providing the Israelites a safe journey out of Egypt when the time comes. And two, Jacob is going to be personally transported back when he dies. And we're going to see that at the end of the book of Genesis. Finally, God says to him, look, Joseph is going to put his hand upon thine eyes, meaning when you die, Joseph will close your eyes, ushering you out and into heaven. And it's so different than what he thought earlier, because he never thought he was going to see Joseph And now he's going to see Joseph. He's going to be there for 17 years living the life of luxury in the greatest nation on earth with comfort and ease while that family builds. And he's going to be a friend of Pharaoh. A friend of Pharaoh. That's not what he thought was going to happen before. He thought he was going to never see Joseph before he died. But we're going to close today with the arrival in Egypt. And Genesis 46 verses 5 to 7 state, "And Jacob rose up from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried Jacob their father and their little ones and their wives and the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. And they took their cattle and their goods which they had gotten in the land of Canaan and came into Egypt, Jacob and all his seed with him, his sons and his sons' sons with him, his daughters and his sons' daughters, and all his seed brought he with him into Egypt." So after he worships God, and he gets this divine revelation that it's okay to go there, it's the right thing to do, I'm ordaining this, I want you to go there, I'm going to be with you, comforting you, he brings everybody with him, his sons, his grandchildren, his daughters. And his daughters are not mentioned except in a few obscure places in the Bible. The only one that actually is named is Dinah, in order for us to see the incident at Shechem and how that helped in the initial stages to build them into a feared nation in Canaan. So this move is going to last 400 years. 400 years. None of his family would remain in Canaan. There are some liberal commentators who like to say that some did, but there's no evidence that that happened at all. They all came. And next week we're going to see the list, and I'll put it in a chart for you about each one of them that came and who they all were. The Bible is so incredible that it names people, it gives times, it gives dates, it gives places. It's not obscure. It actually tells us who, what, why, when, where, and how. So Jacob's going to spend the last 17 years of his life in Egypt at the behest of the two highest officers in the government, Pharaoh and his beloved son Joseph. Now, I put a couple of charts or drawings, if you will, in your notes that these came from, at least the one in black and white, it came from the tomb of Khonkhotep III at Beni Hassan. It's actually in there. It's a black and white scratched mural, if you will, on the walls of that cave. And this is from Bible and Spade magazine in winter spring of 1983, which is an archaeological magazine showing this depiction of the family coming into Egypt. And then an artist has taken that third horizontal bar there and has colored it so we can see it a little closer. The modern village of Beni Hassan is about 160 miles south of modern Cairo. It's still there. Still got the same writings in the walls of the cave. It's interesting.